WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Eggs for breakfast? In this economy? I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. If you've been to the grocery store lately, you've probably noticed that egg prices are through the roof. And we can blame the nationwide shortage on bird flu. Grocery stores like Aldi, Whole Foods, and Trader Joe's are now limiting how many cartons of eggs you can purchase at a time. I know at Costco, it's 3 cartons per customer. And for farmers in Illinois, it's been a tough road. As they fight to manage the spread, some have been forced to cull entire flocks. In just November and December, bird flu wiped out more than 17 million chickens across the country. At Cockadoodle Farm, located in South Suburban Madison, owner Marty Thomas says his troubles began in mid-January with a flock of nearly 3,000 hens. I reached out to Marty to learn more about what happened to his birds.
It was a Sunday morning, and it was bitterly cold. It was like one of the very first, you know, bitter cold weeks. And we lost like 30 birds of the 3,000, mm-hmm. which is unusual, you know. But, you know, being that it was really, really cold and we, you know, constant battle with the water freezing for the chickens. And, you know, we were just like, we thought it was probably environmental. And then the next day, a couple hundred died. So we consulted with a vet. The vet actually agreed with us because there was no symptoms. The birds showed no symptoms. And we also had a separate flock that was perfectly fine. And he was like, if it was the avian flu, chances are that that separate flock would be going as well, right?
Oh, okay.
And so we operated under the assumptions it was environmental for a good 3 days until that separate flock started dying as well. And then the USDA got called in and confirmed that it was the avian flu a few days later. It was a few days after we first noticed they were dying.
Yeah. They came out to your farm in hazmat suits, I hear, to inspect what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of protocol and it's kind of overwhelming and just to have to walk around in hazmat suits like that, where, you know, everything was fine the day before, you know,
yes,
is really wild. By the time that the USDA got on our farm, there was only like 600 birds that were alive.
Wow.
So they didn't come on and like call the whole flock. The flock died naturally. Most of it died naturally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to be clear, do you know what initially caused the bird flu outbreak?
The best guess is it was from like wild birds in the area. So our birds are pasture raised, which means they're out in the environment and their feeders were out in the environment as well. So the wild birds had access to the feeders that the chickens. So they're all sharing the same feed at times. So the best guess is that that's what caused it, was the interaction with the wild birds there by the feed.
Mm. So we know bird flu is highly contagious, and I hear your farm is currently under quarantine. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest concern is going farm to farm. Mm-hmm. And that's what the quarantine is in place for, is they don't want, they're just trying to minimize farm traffic. And the biggest concern with that is, you know, farm to farm traffic.
Yeah. So I'm so sorry to hear all of this, because it's definitely a lot to deal with all at once. Oh. But how have you remained healthy through all of it?
Yeah, I mean, we were never really that concerned, just because that's not where the biggest concern lies, you know, and we don't. I'm on the other side of cancer, and it's kind of why we're doing what we're doing in the first place.
Okay.
And so we can control the things that, or we can only worry about the things we can control. Right. So, So we were never really worried about our health. And if anybody was going to get sick from this, it's like me on the other side of cancer, immunocompromised, and I'm out there with the birds for like 3 days before we realized it was the avian flu, right?
Right. I want to get into the finance piece of all of this, right? Your farm was producing close to 2,000 dozen eggs a week.
Right, yeah.
That's completely stopped now. So how big of a hit is this for you financially, Marty?
We're losing all of that revenue. And it's something, obviously, I mean, the USDA compensates for the loss of the birds. So there's a little bit there, but it doesn't compensate for the loss of revenue, which is like the bigger thing, like by far. Mm-hmm. So fortunately for us, we're not just the farmers, but we're also an online farmers market, which is the real revenue generating side of our business. So we aggregate from local farms and deliver directly to homes in the southwest suburbs here. And so that's Cockadoodle is that online farmers market. That part of the business is going to continue on.
Okay.
So we'll be able to generate revenue from that, thankfully. Because honestly, if we didn't have that and we were just no revenue coming in for 120 days, that's the length of the quarantine, that could, put us out of business. So fortunately, we were diversified a little bit where that wasn't the case for us.
I mean, as I said before, it's a lot to deal with at the same time, right? You're also, it's heartbreaking for your family, right? You're coping, in addition to the financial piece, with the loss of these animals.
Yeah, that's never easy, right? Getting through that, I think one of the more emotional things for us was just wondering how our community was going to respond to this. Like before we found out on Friday night that it was confirmed as a bird flu. And then the next Saturday morning, we let everybody know, our customers, our community via social, the people that we worked with. Everybody got a notification that very next morning. So we didn't waste much time. We were absolutely as transparent as possible. But the worry was like, what are people going to think?
Yeah.
Like, right? Like, are we going to lose our customers because of this? Like, and I was just hoping that the positive was going to outweigh the negative. That was like all I had to hope for, but definitely really worried that the negative could be impactful. But no, I'm just that the response from our community and customers has been like overwhelmingly positive.
That's good.
It's been very, very an emotional roller coaster for my wife, Mary Kate, and I to like go through this, but the response, like I said, has been so overwhelmingly positive that we're going to get out on the other side of this stronger because of all this, which is amazing. And it's only because of the support that we have from our community and customers.
So do you plan to bring egg production back?
Yes. Yeah. So the egg production is on 120 day quarantine, and that's about June 1st that we're going to be able to open back up again for egg production. But the crazy thing is that this is happening to so many other farms that it's hard to even buy chickens now or chicks. Mm-hmm. So like we can technically start on June 1st, but the question now is, are we going to be able to even buy chicks or chickens? Mm. Because those are so hard to get. So it's kind of unknown when we're going to be able to start rolling from this again, but as soon as possible. Yeah, absolutely.
That's Marty Thomas, owner of Cockadoodle Farm in South Suburban Madison. Thank you so much for checking in with us, Marty, and best of luck to you and your family.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
We spoke to another egg producer, Chad Troutman. He's the owner of Chili Trout Farm in the Kane County village of Burlington. Plus, Ben Felder, the editor-in-chief of Investigate Midwest, a nonprofit news outlet that reports on agribusiness. I started off by asking Chad if any of his chickens have come down with bird flu.
No, because as Marty pointed out, when it comes hard and fast and just wipes you out, basically.
What about other egg producers near you? Have they had outbreaks? And what are the precautions that you are taking that it's keeping your flock safe?
I haven't heard of any near me, but I have heard of bird flu outbreaks amongst wild, usually waterfowl. Mm-hmm. As to me personally, I have not a chicken coop, but a chicken barn.
Okay.
So I try to keep the wild birds out for the most part. Occasionally there's little gaps because, it's an older barn where sparrows will slip in and things like that. But as opposed to Marty, I am free range and pasture range also. However, though, I feed all my girls inside because of coyotes and the bad guys issue.
Right.
Coyotes, hawks, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they go out there to forage for grubs, to eat alfalfa hay, you know, straight off the thing. And also I'm a vegetable producer, so to eat all the fallen vegetables that fall on the ground.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons why mine have a little extra oomph on the flavor. So.
I see. But, well, I understand things could change for you, though, when the weather warms up.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
Because how that will work is... During the winter, I do let them go outside, but they're smart. And if it's below 25 degrees, they're not going anywhere, you know. They have the option, though.
Okay.
But during the spring and summer, of course, when it gets above 50, 55 especially, they're out there for all daylight hours.
Mm.
So they will come in contact with wild birds much more often. So if I hear that another flock near me has been affected, then I would have to go out and purchase nets and like cover them on poles at all times and have a little portable, which I fortunately do have a little portable nesting area where they can run away just in case there is coyotes or raccoons or things like that that are coming after them.
So would you not do that maybe proactively? Purchase the nets and get prepared, knowing how rampant this is right now?
Absolutely. But the margins in my business, especially when you're a small guy like me, are so razor thin. That's hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for something that may or may not happen.
I see.
So, but the one thing is if it does happen, boom, it happens overnight.
Right.
And you got troubles.
Let's bring Ben in here. Ben, what are you hearing about how bird flu's impacting farmers in the Midwest?
Yeah, well, like we just heard, I mean, those margins are very razor thin, and that's a big reality for farmers on the ground. You know, one of the things that we've been following the bird flu epidemic through the poultry industry, obviously, over the past year plus, that's been hitting egg-laying flocks a lot harder than broilers, those that are producing for meat. But over the past year, we've seen it jump into dairy herds. And so it's kind of taking on, you know, a similar spread that we saw in poultry and still see now in dairy herds and really impacting, you know, milk production in a lot of high dairy producing states. But I think that's the biggest, you know, the biggest issue that we're seeing is, as you talk to farmers, is just the loss of revenue when the flocks are cold or die, but also having to weigh, like, how much do you invest to be proactive when those margins are so thin.
Yeah. Well, as you alluded there, I mean, bird flu is impacting dairy cows as well. So why aren't we seeing increases in milk prices? And why aren't we getting sticker shock from the cost of chicken?
Yeah, great question. So there's lots of answers to that. One is when it comes to comparing poultry and dairy, specifically with egg-laying flocks, it's a lot more of a open supply and demand issue with eggs. So as the supply goes down, the demand goes up. On the dairy side of things, though, there are some federal price controls that kind of keep dairy prices in check. Those are meant to kind of protect dairy farmers who are selling to producers. Obviously, dairy and milk is a highly volatile product, so there is an opportunity that a processor could kind of have the upper hand in those negotiations, since the farmer has to get rid of their dairy so quickly. But those price controls try to alleviate that, and that does provide some relief to shoppers. So consumers are not seeing those prices go up incredibly. They've only gone up a couple percent nationwide over the past year. But on the flip side, it's really squeezing dairy farmers. So one thing that we're seeing is those federal price controls, which were recently updated to help kind of offset the cost of the retail on the retail side of things.
Yeah.
But they're squeezing dairy farmers even more, who are also having to spend, you know, extra money trying to mitigate the spread of the virus. Also, when it comes to dairy, cows are typically not killed if they contract the disease or quarantined. But even when they come back from quarantine, we're finding that the production of that cow is less than it was before.
Right.
And then when you look at the broilers, the meat side of things, they're not getting hit as hard as the egg layers, but there's also some, just the way that you sell eggs and meat is different. Obviously, meat can be frozen. The nation's frozen chicken supply has decreased some recently, but it's still well stocked right now.
Chad, have you had to raise the price of your eggs?
I haven't. I should, and I've been told that by my customers, because I used to be on the high end of the organic free-range pasture-raised area. But not amongst that quality of egg. I've always been on the cheaper side of those guys.
I see.
But now mine are downright like the jewels prices, you know. So
for
the factory stuff. So As I always said, though, I want to make it available to everybody, just not the people that have more money, so they can have high-end quality eggs. Mm-hmm. However, though, because of the recent money I've been spending, I might have to raise it a buck, but that would be temporarily, just for like 2-3 months until I can recover.
So
some
these
of
are
that.
The conversations you have to be
absolutely.
You know,
but mine are $8. And what used to be like a year ago, $8, that's a little pricey.
Yeah. Now you got to probably put it up closer
now,
to 10.
Yeah, but now it's like $8, Jesus, they're cheap. That's why, just as was mentioned previously, I do have to, you know, my restaurants, I say, all right, oh, you only get 5, or my private individuals, like 1 or maybe 2 dozen if I know they have
you
a big family.
You start to limit.
Per household.
Yeah. As I mentioned there, Ben, farmers aren't only confronting bird flu, tariffs, and the end of USAID. They're also creating a lot of uncertainty here. So talk to us about how the Trump administration tariff policies are impacting farmers in our state.
Yeah, so many will remember during Trump's first term, tariffs were a big tool for the president in trying to lower costs for exports. And the prices that went up during the first term was really because of retaliatory tariffs from other countries like China, who were responding to our increase in tariffs by increasing their own. I think the big hit for farmers, as we see a return to those policies, one is the increase in costs that are imported into the U.S. It's impacting everyone, including farmers, whether you're buying animal feed or, parts for a tractor or machinery or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But the other big thing that has farmers really worried is just what this is going to do to the price of grain. A lot of grain that's produced in the U.S., including 44% of that that's produced in Illinois, is sold as an export. So as the president implements new tariffs in other countries, including China, and threats against Mexico and Canada, the concern is about retaliatory tariffs and what that would mean, not only in the increase of the cost, but also big customers like China who may shift their buying to other countries.
Yeah.
We saw that during the first term of the president, in which soybeans, for example, China is the largest buyer of soybeans from the U.S. And as those costs were going up because of increased tariffs, they were shifting their buying to countries like Brazil and buying more of that. And I think the thing to keep in mind is that while that shift happens, it doesn't necessarily shift back when tariffs go back down or when policies change. Those markets are sometimes lost forever. And so a lot of the gains that countries like Brazil saw in selling soybeans to China during Trump's first term remained even when he left office.
Interesting. Yeah, another executive order impacting farmers is the elimination of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Now, Chad, USAID doesn't come into play with your small farm business model, but does it impact any of your farming neighbors in rural King County?
Absolutely, it does. $2 billion worth of grain products alone go to USAID from U.S. farmers. I read recently that $4 billion total from U.S. farmers goes into USAID. So because it is such an important program for spreading democracy throughout the world and maintaining our allies and fellow democratic governments, not having that hurts both the farmers and the countries is going to dually. Mm-hmm. But the neighbors, they don't as much bother them about what it does with the food, but just that it is being bought by the agency.
Yeah.
And that's really troubling on these guys. And then also USAID does, and things like the Farm Service Agency, which has been cut drastically as well. They do things like conservation programs and a lot of things like that. And both conservation, no-till, low-till type services.
Yeah.
And underneath the previous administration, those farmers that engaged in a lot of those projects, they were said they'd be paid for these projects, and then those payments were halted. And that's causing a lot of guys to be deathly afraid that I've heard from personally with my own ears. Some 5- and 6-figure dollar amounts that were promised to them that they signed contracts for. And then now Trump has stopped those contracts from being paid, even though it's already signed contracts and things like that. And that has them very nervous.
So lots of uncertainty around that federal funding.
Absolutely.
For some has already been lost.
Yeah, because you do the work first and then you get paid later. Well, they've done the work. They're not getting the pay.
Ben, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, I think just the uncertainty about federal funding as a whole. I mean, we saw a couple of weeks ago the administration try to halt a large amount of that funding, and that was paused by a federal judge. But just the uncertainty of what that means. I mean, farmers received more than $10 billion in direct government payments last year, and nearly half of that came from conservation programs, like we've just mentioned. Yeah. And that doesn't even include the federal crop insurance program, which is another kind of $19 billion. And I think those conservation programs are really critical to a lot of farmers on the ground. And, you know, some of our reporting in recent weeks has looked at, you know, these, we're talking about billions of dollars. That's a big price tag. But when you look at local communities, those five and six figure projects, you know, they maybe don't catch our attention like the $1 billion figures, but are critically important, whether you're putting in new drainage, you know, systems or other infrastructure, that the local farming community is really relying on. And a lot of that stuff takes upfront cost. You know, some of the projects that we've explored, you know, local communities have already put up, you know, thousands of dollars for engineering expenses, legal review, with the promise that the federal government is going to help pay for all, if not a large part of the project. And that uncertainty is just really kind of creating a lot of worry, a lot of fear moving forward.
Yeah. So a federal judge Thursday ordered the Trump administration to temporarily pause the freeze on all funding of USAID programs. Give us the very latest, Ben.
Well, the latest is we're still waiting on a final decision on that, or where that's going to go next in an appeal. But it was such a large order that there's some confusion on whether or not the administration is actually following the judge's orders, because we're already hearing about some programs that are being paused or delayed or pulled back. And even if it's a temporary pause, that means a lot of these local communities are having to float you know, some of these expenses. And it's not just the funding. I mean, we've been, you know, you were talking earlier about just kind of the loss in federal employees, and we're seeing large, you know, we're already starting to see kind of massive firings and lots of offices that handle some of these payments. So even if the funding is technically still on, having the federal employees to help process that funding to be delivered, yeah, it's also causing delays.
So the president's threats of mass deportations, that could also cause problems for farmers, right, Ben? What are you hearing from farmers?
Well, the agriculture sector as a whole relies greatly on foreign workers. Now, that's not just, you know, a lot of times undocumented workers get a lot of attention, but a lot of these workers are visa workers that are legally allowed to be here in the country. And so there's still some confusion about kind of what the future of visa programs will look like under the Trump administration. I think the big thing to look at going forward is, as the president has tried to make a big show of force in going after undocumented residents here in the country, so far that focus has been, and this is not the greatest term to use, but kind of the low-hanging fruit, a lot of those that have already maybe been arrested or currently incarcerated and county and state facilities, and deporting those individuals. But when you look at the numbers that the president has said that he wants to deport, the only way to achieve those numbers or to even get close is to go well beyond those that are the quote unquote criminals, the ones, yeah, that have already been arrested. That's going to mean immigration crackdowns in ag communities and communities with meatpacking facilities as well, mm-hmm, where you do see a lot of these workers. And so I think one big thing that's going to be interesting to watch is, how does the corporate agriculture community, the meatpacking companies that largely supported the president, how are they going to respond if and when they start to see their own workforce impacted by this effort?
Yeah. Final thought from you, Chad. What are you keeping an eye on for your farm?
For my farm personally, keeping an eye on the near future, and that is just keeping it avian flu free. Beyond that, I'm interested in the bigger and larger picture too, because, yeah, of course that affects me directly and indirectly.
Oh yeah.
Even down to the small business loans that are available through Farmer Service Association agency rather, and numerous other things. But also, you want to see your neighbors do well. It's one of the things that we're all in this together.
Yeah.
And when I know that they're hurting and they're frightened, and you know, and these aren't people that are usually quite easily scared. World with the Poachers, we just had three tornadoes last year right in my neighborhood, you know? So they're used to...
There's some resilience there.
Yes.
They're used to bouncing back.
Yes, they're used to bouncing back. Yeah. They're used to adversity. But this one is a whole different type of thing. And a bunch of these guys voted in that direction, so they're confused and feeling betrayed.
Well, best of luck to you. My thanks to you, Chad Troutman, owner of Chili Trout Farm in Kane County, and Ben Felder, who's editor-in-chief of Investigate Midwest. Thank you both.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman and edited by Meha Ahmed. It was mixed by Ari Mejia. Subscribe to stay up to date wherever you listen or find us at WBEZ.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We appreciate you tuning in.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.